And welcome to The Morning Magazine here at Community Radio, listener-supported KGNU. I'm Hannah Lee Myers. Coming up on today's show, we'll hear about a climate summit happening in Boulder tomorrow. Then, on Sunday in Longmont, there will be a forum for Democratic Senate candidates. The organizers are a coalition of groups in the Longmont Latinx community. On Connections, Duncan Campbell will talk about the Trump-pocalypse. As always, your calls will be welcome. That's coming up on Connections at 8:30. But first, your local headlines. Here's Steve Miller.
Even with population growth, the development boom, a new study by Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment, found Boulder County's water quality remains good, but not great. The Daily Camera reports that data collected by the Keep It Clean Partnership, which coordinates water quality monitoring for seven municipalities in Boulder County, shows the region's water quality has remained relatively stable over the last 5 years. Although the state did designate the section of Boulder Creek from 13th Street East to its confluence with South Boulder Creek as impaired, due partly by the way Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment changed how it measures E. coli. The Keep It Clean Partnership said that getting rid of E. coli from a waterway is exceptionally difficult in urbanized areas. They said there are ways people can help reduce levels, including picking up dog waste, properly maintaining your home's septic tank, limit the amount of fertilizer applied to lawns, and ensure irrigation systems aren't overwatering and sending excess water into the gutter. Colorado Parks and Wildlife confirmed Wednesday that a pack of wolves is roaming near the northwest corner of the state. Lucy Haggard has more.
On Sunday, officers found an animal carcass surrounded by wolfish tracks and sought to locate the animals. The officers heard wolves howling in the distance and were able to spot them, through binoculars, about 2 miles from the carcass. They estimate about 6 wolves were in the pack. Director Dan Prenslow noted in a news release that gray wolves remain federally protected under the Endangered Species Act, placing them in the hands of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The sighting comes as Colorado prepares to vote on whether or not to manually reintroduce wolves to the state. The Rocky Mountain Wolf Action Fund's ballot measure qualified earlier this month to be included on the November ballot. If the initiative passes, it will be the first in the country where voters, not just wildlife managers, determine whether or not to bring back an endangered species. Gray wolves were hunted out of the state sometime before 1940, and reintroducing them could fill in the gaps of a population that stretches from Alaska to Mexico. Supporters and opponents of the measure are still debating the ecological effects of bringing wolves back. For KGNU, I'm Lucy Haggard.
An online survey of 734 Colorado residents in August estimated 84% of Coloradans supported the reintroduction of wolves on the state's western slope. The Colorado Sun reports that the CSU survey examined the level of public support for wolf reintroduction, how residents see wolves in Colorado impacting their daily lives, and profiles of wolf supporters and opponents. The study released this week shows nearly 80% of residents surveyed on the West Slope indicated they would support a ballot measure. Initiative 107, if approved by voters in November, would direct the Colorado Parks and Wildlife Commission to develop a plan to introduce about 10 gray wolves a year starting in 2023. The study's authors urged that in any implementation plan, include widespread public outreach based on science that would balance the potential positive and negative impacts of the reintroduction of wolves. In Montana, where the state began reimbursing ranchers for livestock lost to wolves in 2008, they added grizzly bears in 2013 and mountain lions in 2017. In 2019, Montana's livestock board paid $247,000 in claims on more than 360 animals killed. And in today's weather, mostly sunny, highs in the low 50s, and then tonight, mostly cloudy, low around 30 degrees. Mostly sunny days continue through the weekend with highs in the 50s. And in Nederland, temperature right now is 28 degrees, and this weekend, partly sunny through the weekend, high of 35, Saturday, 40 degrees on Sunday.
This Sunday, the Longmont Museum will host a debate for the Democratic candidates who are seeking to be the party's nominee to challenge Cory Gardner in this year's Senate race. KGNU's Rosanna Longo spoke with the moderator of the debate, Nick Lopez.
One thing that has become clear as we've progressed over the last few decades is that the Latinx community is growing and its voice is growing in the political atmosphere. Today, we know that in Colorado, more than 20% of all Coloradans identify as part of the Latinx community, and it's an active group that participates in the political process. And so it's really important that we have events focused on Latinx issues. I was fortunate enough to be asked to moderate this really incredible town hall event, mainly because of my background. You know, I grew up in Boulder County in Longmont, Colorado, in a traditional Latinx family. I've attended the schools in Boulder County, lived in Colorado, went to school in Colorado, and really have strong ties with family and friends to the area. And I've in doing that, I've been able to understand and appreciate so many of the issues that my grandparents and my parents and my generation have dealt with. And as a Latinx millennial, I also understand the plight that many millennials have to deal with on some of the most important issues of today. And so those issues for the Latinx community are really wide-ranging, right? It includes everything from healthcare and ensuring that the Latinx community has adequate access to healthcare, can afford healthcare coverage. It includes immigration and making sure that our friends and our families are treated fairly when they come to the United States, and that those dreamers that are living within our communities are protected and have some certainty in the lives that they live. Another important issue is education, particularly for Latinx millennials. You know, we live in a time now where students are responsible for their entire education in a way that it did not exist in the past. And so we have students that either can't afford to go to college or have to take on a tremendous amount of student loan debt in order to graduate college, which has a tremendous effect on, economic prosperity and a whole host of issues with developing wealth in the Latinx community into the future. We also have issues related to housing and being able to buy a home and accumulate wealth, or being able to deal with the high cost of rent that exists in Longmont, Boulder County, and all of throughout Colorado. So there's a whole host of issues that we hope to address at this town hall. We're viewing this town hall as a unique opportunity to be able to get all the Democratic candidates for the United States Senate to be able to talk individually about these really important issues that are facing the Latinx community. We don't get a lot of these chances, even though, as I said, the Latinx community is a growing force and political power. We don't get a lot of these forums. And so this is the first step to be able to hear from so many of them.
What are those issues that we are going to listen from them that we have not yet listened?
One thing that's critical for these candidates to understand is that many of the broad policy issues that they discuss every single day in their campaigns have a particular impact on the Latinx community. And many times, the Latinx community is disproportionately affected by many of the issues that these candidates talk about on a daily basis. And so one of the things that we're going to do at this town hall event is make sure that all the questions that are asked of the candidates and all the answers that are provided by the candidate are couched in terms of the Latinx community and how those issues directly impact the Latinx community, and how those specific candidates will provide solutions and potentially adopt legislation that will have not only a huge impact on the broader population, but specifically how it will benefit the lives of the Latinx community.
During this forum, that's going to be Sunday, January the 26th at 2 in the afternoon at the Longmont Museum, you're going to have Spanish interpretation. Important to notice that, because it's inviting to a wider community of Spanish-speaking people that are affected by many issues and that many times they are not aware of what's going on or how they can get more information about the issues and be more active in the community.
That's a great point, and it's absolutely true. This town hall is really intended to be inclusive of the entire Latinx community and really the public at large. There will be Spanish translation available, and I think it's really important that we provide those services so that folks do have the opportunity to really engage and listen and understand what are the issues that are being talked about? How can we as a community get more involved? How can we use our voice as political power moving forward? And it'll be a really great opportunity for all members of the Latinx community to really hear how the candidates propose to address the issues that are important to them. The reason why the community should come together and attend this event is because you're going to have the next nominee for the Democratic Party who's running for the U.S. Senate on that stage speaking directly to you. That candidate is going to be speaking to you about Latinx communities, about Latinx issues. And many times we don't get answers to the questions we have or policy proposals to the issues that we deal with. And this is an opportunity to hear from those candidates directly so that when the election comes around, both the primary election and the general election, Latinx community can go out and use their vote as their voice.
I've been talking to Nick Lopez today. He's a Colorado native and a Latino attorney with deep ties to the community. Lopez grew up in Longmont, attended college and law school in Colorado, and has volunteered with numerous community programs throughout the state.
The Latinx community now nationally is the second largest demographic voting bloc in the country. What we saw in the 2018 midterm elections indicated that when Latinos go out and vote, significant results can happen. And so it's important that Latinos come out in force and they use their power in the election to make sure that the interests and the issues that are important to them are identified and addressed by the candidates that are running for political office.
Who is going to be there in attendance so that people can listen to them directly?
Yeah, we have all the candidates for the Democratic nomination for the United States Senate are confirmed that they're going to be joining us. That includes Diana Bray, Lorena Garcia, David Goldfischer, former Governor John Hickenlooper, former Speaker of the House Andrew Romanoff, Stephanie Rose Spaulding, Michelle Warren, and Trish Zornio. It's really a good, diverse group of candidates, and we're really, really happy that they'll be joining us, and we're really interested in seeing what they have to say about the issues important to our community.
It is an event that is happening January the 26th at 2 in the afternoon in Longmont Museum, and it's organized by Longmont Latinx Voice, and it is a rare opportunity to listen from all those candidates in one event.
Nick Lopez will be the moderator of the Senate candidate debate happening this Sunday at the Longmont Museum starting at 2 p.m. Find out more at longmontlatinxvoice.com. Tomorrow in Boulder, people involved in renewable energy and sustainability will gather for the Boulder Mayor's Community Conversation on Climate and Local Clean Energy. Maeve Conran spoke with one of the presenters, who will be speaking about microgrids.
Lily Franklin is the editor of the Microgrid News, which is published by Homer, and they are involved in the microgrid here in Boulder. Now, Lily, you are going to be speaking on resilience and the role of microgrids as part of the Boulder Mayor's Community Conversation on Climate and Local Clean Energy. Well, before we delve into all of this, for those who don't know, what is a microgrid?
A microgrid is a local energy distribution system, and there's actually a lot of different definitions that people are using these days. It's all kind of blurry, but the Department of Energy defines it as a local energy distribution system that is capable of operating independently from the main grid if need be.
So is that as simple as having solar panels on your roof?
No. We think of microgrids at Homer Energy as hybrid systems that involve multiple energy resources. So that could mean solar plus batteries, or it could mean a combination of solar and wind plus batteries, or even adding a generator in there, a natural gas or a diesel generator. And it also requires some sort of control system to tell these different components when they should be used. So it could tell the solar system to be operating during the middle of the day and then switch on the batteries later in the afternoon.
So this sounds something that might be more extensive than you might get in a domestic, in a house situation. Is it something that you would see maybe in businesses? Where do we see these?
Right now, the most at Homer Energy, we started out designing microgrids in the developing world in remote villages that had no access to the grid at all. And many of these microgrids are still in place. Many of them are diesel only microgrids. And the way that Homer Energy started really is that our CEO, Peter Lee Linthal, worked at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, trying to help these villages with their diesel microgrids clean up their energy supply by adding renewable components. So they might have solar panels plus a diesel generator that would switch on as a backup system when the sun wasn't shining. And now, as the price of solar and the price of batteries is declining so rapidly, solar plus battery microgrids are becoming economically feasible and even competing with fossil generation in many places. The reason that microgrids are very interesting for resilience is that they can stand alone and they can operate completely independently from the grid. So there has to be an inverter or some sort of switch that will switch off and that will separate them from the grid in the case of a weather emergency or a natural disaster or even an outage, which we have all the time here in Boulder. You know, you come home from work and you see your lights flashing, your alarm clock flashing, and you realize that there's been a power outage. Well, a microgrid can be designed to switch on automatically and provide power to the people in that local energy system when the main grid goes down.
Are we seeing these microgrids then here in the U.S.?
Yes. One thing that's very interesting is that the terrible wildfires that we've seen in California have prompted the state to move ahead really quickly with microgrids. And in Northern California, for example, where PG&E is the main utility, they've put out requests for 20 microgrids to be built by June, which is incredibly fast. And then in the city of Santa Barbara, for example, they want to build 18 microgrids in each of the schools in the Santa Barbara School District. So that's 38 microgrids under development immediately in California right now. So that's unprecedented. The pace is really picking up. We see microgrids being developed all over Massachusetts and in New York in particular because of the results of Hurricane Sandy, where they lost billions of dollars through power outages. For weeks after the hurricane, the power was off in certain communities there. So microgrids are great for that. Another place we're seeing people developing them is Houston, where they have terrible hurricane damage and frequent hurricanes. So the market is really growing fast in the United States.
It seems then that microgrids certainly play a role in resiliency in the face of some of these increasing natural disasters that we're seeing. But do they play a role in helping us transition to cleaner and more renewable energy?
Yes, that's really important. People talk about the trifecta of benefits from microgrids, which includes resiliency, environmental benefits through the addition of more renewable energy to the mix, and cost reduction. And the way that you get cost reduction is that utilities can often charge more for peak use at certain times of the year. And these kinds of special rates, which charge you for the hottest days in the summer, for example, are designed to help the utility save money, actually, because the utility needs extra generating power if it's going to meet a huge surge in demand at any given day of the year. So if these peak moments can be shaved off, or even peak days, this really helps the utility get by with fewer generation resources. So this is becoming common all over the country. So cost cutting is one key thing, because microgrids can come in with batteries and or solar energy and shave off some of these peaks. Microgrids also, because they allow better management of energy, can allow us to put more renewables on the system than would otherwise be possible. And then last is the resilience factor, which we already talked about, which means that people in a local community or even a part of a community can have power during a power outage to the main grid.
Well, Lily Franklin with Homer Energy is going to speak all about resilience and the role of microgrids as part of the Boulder Mayor's Community Conversation on Climate and Local Clean Energy. It's happening on Saturday from 9 a.m. to noon at the West Boulder Senior Centre. Thank you so much.
The Brink is a radio storytelling project about what is needed to transition to a more just environment and society. It tells stories of inequality, struggle, and transformation. It's a collaboration between the Environmental Studies Program at CU Boulder in partnership with KGNU and the Just Transition Collaborative. This morning, we'll hear about climate education in schools with a report from Allison Willick, Elizabeth Kalowaitis, and Megan Quinn.
I want to acknowledge all of you for showing up, because an investment in your community is an investment in yourself.
It is a beautiful sunny day on September 20th, the day of the 2019 Denver climate strike. While walking around, we asked these fanatic, young, environmentally conscious minds if they had climate change education during the school day.
Do you ever remember in school first learning about climate change?
No, I don't.
It wasn't specifically taught to us.
I did not learn about climate change.
No, I don't think I ever really did learn about it.
No. No.
As you heard, these people of all ages were not educated about the changing climate during their daily education. Climate change is a threat that will change the world that our youth lives in, and the children are aware of this. Brett Fleischman, who works with 350.org, was at this climate strike and had a personal perspective about this subject as a father.
And my kid knows about climate change. He's 5 years old and he knows about climate change. He's like, oh yeah, the world's getting hotter and that's bad.
Amanda Carrico, an environmental psychology professor at CU Boulder, also believes in the importance of gaining this knowledge at a very young age.
More and more psychologists are bringing in environmental issues into their classrooms quite a lot. In my experience, it's still relatively constrained. My instinctual answer is that I think we have to start early. I mean, I think, you know, yes, it's very technical and scientific, but there are ways to talk about problems and the science behind them that makes it accessible to students of all age.
There are implications that make it difficult to introduce climate change education in the United States because of state funding, different districts, and different types of schools. Chris Hansen, representative of House District 6, was available to provide a politically driven perspective on climate education and the complications associated with it.
I think the budget constraints that we face leave very little funding for those types of programs, because we're at this point not funding the base load and kind of the basic functions of government. And to give you an example, we're about $10 billion behind in funding K-12. So we have these huge accumulated deficits of the basic functions of government, which makes it really hard then to have some of these other programs that very much would like to have.
Hansen also spoke to the fact that different types of schools have different funding options and focuses. This was similar to the perspective that a high school senior named Rowan at the climate strike exhibited about her own charter school, the Denver School of Science and Technology.
DSST is a charter, it's a separate education from other DPS schools, so it might have either a more elevated or just a more focused attempt at educating their students on like matters such as climate change.
A stable, centralized, and standardized educational system surrounding climate change is not yet available in the United States, but this is not true for the whole globe.
This just in, Italy will be the first country in the world to mandate climate change education in schools.
The education minister in Italy strongly believed and advocated for society and the environment to be a core value that Italian students learn in every aspect of education. This is the type of policy that students at the climate strike, parents, educators, and environmentally minded politicians in the United States gravitate toward. Back at the climate strike.
And love and peace! And we must take care of the children and Grandmother Earth!
It was important to understand what students, peers, and professionals felt an ideal climate education system was.
I think Colorado is in such a unique position. I feel like we're kind of the swing state when it comes to environmental policy.
If I were to issueize it, I would say let's focus on justice and we can be teaching that in school. It shouldn't be its own class, it should be part of every class because the world is changing drastically. So in math and English and in science, we should be talking about climate change and how our lives are gonna have to be very, very different.
I mean, I think that one required class, even if it was just for a semester.
So as far as what it would look like, I'm not sure. I mean, I would leave that to educators and scientists who are perfectly skilled and capable of designing things that are effective. We just need to listen to them. I think that we relate to the game in incorporating it into curriculums as young as, you know, preschool, kindergarten, all the way up.
These are the people in our society that can see how early climate education, like the new Italian mandate, could benefit future young Americans.
We'll have more from the Brink series on Monday's Morning Magazine. Thanks for listening to the Morning Magazine on KGNU. I'm Hanalei Myers.